Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop RPG mechanic and ask if it'd kill a man just to watch him die. My name is Sam Dunnewald and my co-host this week is Sam Roberts. The Dice Exploder Season 4 Pledge Drive is still live on Backerkit through the end of the week. Vote on what mechanic you think the show should cover. Pick up my secret unpublished game. The more we raise, the more episodes I'll make before taking another break. Come trap me in a podcast prison of my own making. And thank you so much for your support and for listening. We are also, right now, still in the middle of the Dice Exploder D&D miniseries, and today's episode is the most regular-ass episode of Dice Exploder that this series has to offer. Less sweeping generalizations about the brand, more analysis of whatever weird little thing my co-host wanted to talk about. Sam Roberts is one of the authors of Escape from Dino Island, a one-shot or short series Jurassic Park-inspired PBTA game that I wish we saw more games like. I invited him on the show because we talk a lot on Discord, and I just wanted to talk with him about a normal little mechanic. And the weird little thing he picked to talk about is prestige classes from Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition. So in D&D, you pick a class like Fighter, and every time you level up, you can choose to get another level in Fighter, or you can multi-class and add a level of Wizard or Druid. But in the 3rd edition of the game, they added prestige classes, classes that you can only take once you've met some other requirements. You're no longer a level 3 fighter, level 1 wizard, you're a level 3 fighter, level 1 chainmaster, or dwarven defender. And prestige classes could get really weird with it. Prestige classes lead with the fiction. Instead of regular D&D advancement, in which you mostly aspire to have a higher number or turn into an even bigger kind of bear, they encourage you to aspire to be a member of a group, to get a specific person's blessing, or to go to a specific far-flung realm. At least, that's what they might have done. As Sam R. says in this episode, he thinks D&D dropped the ball on them almost immediately, and they sunk even further as 3rd edition evolved into 3.5. So they're a noble failure in a way. What can we learn from their corpse? We get into it, along with a boots-on-the-ground discussion of what our experiences were like actually playing D&D 3rd edition, and an exploration of advancement as a concept at large. How does it work in most games, and how might it work instead? Let's find out. Here is Sam Roberts with prestige classes. Sam Roberts, thanks for being on Dice Exploder.
Good to be here.
Welcome to the Dungeons & Dragons series.
Oh, no.
Which edition of Dungeons & Dragons are we talking about today?
I'm talking about Dungeons & Dragons 3rd edition. And,
yeah.
And I want to clarify, more 3rd edition than 3.5. I spent most of my time playing 3rd edition.
Me too. I actually wanted to just like pause here and like remember being 10 years old and like those books coming into the game store. It was the first time that a new edition of Dungeons and Dragons had come out since I had started playing 2 years earlier at the age of 8. And the covers on those things are so cool. Opening them up, the art really was, I don't want to say it was better because the weird old edition art was also really cool, but it felt more like the magic cards I had been playing. It felt a little bit more realized. Like, I love just looking at the class tables. Like, they got rid of Thaco and made it a base attack bonus. Like, I thought they always should. You know, it was just so cool to page through and see everything that they had updated and learned and, like, what this new world was going to be that we were exploring.
Totally. It's funny because I was a little bit older, I think. I was probably, like, 14 or 15 when 3rd edition came out. And I've been a big Warhammer player at the time. And so for me, I didn't even clock the beauty of the books, the feel, which now I look back on them and I'm like, oh, these are so tangible and tactile in a way that I love. But at the time, I was just enamored with how much they had streamlined the rules, which is now funny as an indie player to be like, look at these streamlined rules, because it's a huge, huge, dense, complicated book. But the fact
like
that they
had,
you know, streamlined the whole thing to like the single D20 mechanic and the sort of systemization of it. The reason I mentioned Warhammer was because my friends and I, we would just argue about the rules all the time. And this felt like it took very seriously the idea of balance and cohesion and the systematic idea, which in retrospect, I don't know if it succeeded at, but certainly it succeeded at selling that idea and making that piece really exciting.
I remember the new classes that came with the book and the new races too were really exciting. Like seeing half-orcs was, oh, what a revelation. And barbarians, it was an entirely new class that we could explore.
Sorcerer, oh my gosh, sorcerer all day.
Whoa, sorcerer, yeah.
A spellcaster that didn't have to memorize their spells was What? You could do that? It was really mind-blowing stuff at the time. It's just funny to look back on.
Yeah. So today we're talking about prestige classes. Do you want to walk us through what the hell this was? This was a third edition original. So, but give it to us. What were prestige classes?
So, a little bit of context. In earlier editions of Dungeons and Dragons, more or less, you took one class and you stuck with it. There was a way in AD&D to drop your old class for a while and switch to a new one, which is kind of similar to like Powered by the Apocalypse when you swap out your playbook for a new one. Or you could start off as a multi-class like fighter wizard, and then you'd be a fighter wizard for your entire career. But in third edition, you basically chose your class every time you leveled up. And that was their approach to multi-classing, but it also created the space for prestige classes. And prestige classes were classes you could only take after you had met a certain number of requirements. Some of them would be mechanical requirements, like you have to have 8 skill points in knowledge religion, or it could be in fiction requirements, like you have to have assassinated someone for no other reason than to join the Assassin's Guild, which is really one of them.
Ugh, what a
We'll
line.
talk more about that in a bit, but that was the heart of it. And I think what was really interesting about prestige classes was when they were first pitched. Interestingly, they were in the Dungeon Master's Guide. They very quickly became a player-facing mechanic that was featured in player handbooks and things like that. But the first time they show up, it's in the Dungeon Master's Guide. And I won't read the whole description because it's very long, but I hope we can put it in the show notes. But they're really pitched as organizations or like diegetic classes. So like if you're an assassin, you're an assassin because you're a member of the Assassin's Guild, or you might be a lore master because you are literally in this world a lore master. So the premise was, here are some example prestige classes, but what you really want to do as a dungeon master, and the reason this is in the Dungeon Master's Guide, is create your own prestige classes that are unique to each campaign setting, so that are rooted in the themes and setting that you've built, and that give characters and players entree into owning this setting and taking the setting and making it player facing. It has a little bit of that like custom moves feel.
I was really struck rereading. I was on the 3.5 edition of the Dungeon Master's Guide here, but at the end of the Prestige Classes chapter is this section that describes all of that. That is basically like the best Prestige Classes are going to be the ones that you make custom for your table. And it reminded me almost of the Apocalypse World chapter on making your own custom moves and how the specificity of that is really going to be exciting and what goes far. And I really don't think they spend enough time on that here. Like, you are absolutely right that they are framing things that way, but I don't remember getting that when I read these. You know, I just looked at the lore master and thought, that's cool. I want to do that. I didn't, as a DM, and I was doing a lot of DMing at this time, think about making my own content. And I wish they had pushed that harder.
Yeah, so one of the things I find fascinating about prestige classes and love about them from a sort of historical perspective, I guess, is that in the way they're actually executed, even from the very first time they're introduced, they kind of drop the ball. And so it's really interesting, that tension is really interesting to me. So like they say, the first thing they tell you is these are going to be in fiction concepts. And then they present you with the arcane archer, the assassin, the lore master. And these are not, they don't even give the feel ultimately of being, you know, like in the Forgotten Realms campaign setting, there's the Purple Dragon Knight. And you might not have Purple Dragon Knights in your personal campaign setting, but at least I understand that like I want to join the Purple Dragon Knights. That feels like something that could exist in the world. Whereas like you know, it's they didn't quite land the plane. But the idea is so, it gets in my head.
Well, and then that kind of transitions into like a broader conversation about advancement and like what does advancement look like in conversation that I know you and I have had a lot of times. Like, I think in traditional Dungeons and Dragons, the way advancement works is you kill stuff and then you become more powerful so you can kill bigger stuff and you have more treasure and you get more stuff. And
Totally.
part of the joy of advancement is in like looking forward to what cool, powerful things am I going to be able to do in the future? What's the seventh level spell that I'm really excited about? I remember Bigby's crushing hand, I really wanted, right?
Right. And so I think you and I agree that most advancement is kind of nonsense and unnecessary. I think in D&D, advancement is such a core part of the game that it's you can't really excise it without losing something. But I think advancement does something really interesting in D&D, which is that you can how do I say this? There's an end point, like you're building towards something. And I think in D&D, you're constantly always looking towards something you're building towards. And that's such the fun of the game. But it's also, I think, a big problem with the game because you're looking at your player's handbook and you're imagining, okay, whatever level I'm going to get Bigby's hand. And that has nothing to do with what's going on in the game, right? That has nothing to do with what's going on in your campaign. You're going around, you're in some dungeon, or you're parleying with the elves in the woods, and you're knowing that every day I'm getting a little bit closer to Fireball. And what I love about prestige classes is they square that circle. They say every day you're going to get closer to being a Purple Dragon Knight, but the way you get closer to being a Purple Dragon Knight is by first finding the Purple Dragon Knights, convincing them to let you into their order. So it gives you that thing that I think is missing sometimes from like a Powered by the Apocalypse game, where you're really just playing to find out, and you don't have the ability to think as long term. With prestige classes, you get to think really long term about who your character is going to be, but it drives you back towards the
Who
fiction.
they are going to aspire to be at any rate.
Right. And then there's that wonderful tension of the game, which is, will I actually get to be a Purple Dragon Knight, or maybe something else will happen? Like, I was looking through a lot of prestige classes before this conversation, and I noticed something funny. One of my favorite books in third edition is The Manual of the Planes. And most of the prestige classes in Manual of the Planes are not super interesting, although the Gatecrasher is one that like I love. He's just a guy who breaks into planes, and like who doesn't want to play that character, right? But it says before you can take this prestige class, you must have visited two planes. But it points out that you don't have to have done it on purpose. So, like, you could have been pulled to those planes. And so I love the idea of like, I'm just a thief. I'm bopping around. Suddenly, I discover over the course of this campaign, I've been to two different planes. So you are playing to find out what happened. It's that really fun dynamic of this is where I want to go, and this is where I ended up, and maybe now I'm going to be a gatecrasher instead of a thieves guild member or whatever I was trying to do.
Yeah, you're not just looking forward to being able to cast Fireball and running around and murdering as many goblins as you can so that you can get to that point. You are like looking forward to joining the assassins, and part of that is a mechanical like leveling up until you meet the requirements, but part of that is also like kill someone for no other reason than to join the assassins. Like it's an entire adventure baked into that prerequisite. And that this is just rephrasing what you've already said, but that like brings the aspiration to the present day. Like the fact that you want to cast Fireball eventually now has like a direct impact on what we are doing here right now in a way that just murdering goblins is very generic and uninteresting.
Right. Like, I think about it almost like prestige classes make character growth into treasure. And so what I mean by that is, you go out on a quest into the dungeon to get the magical flaming sword or whatever. And what your base class says, what most editions of D&D say, is you're going to get that magic sword no matter what happens. You don't need to go into that dungeon. You could go into a completely different dungeon, but if you really want that magic sword, you're going to get it. And prestige classes say, no. If you want to be a Purple Dragon Knight, you got to go into this specific dungeon and find the specific one guy who can teach you how to be a Purple Dragon Knight. And so it makes your character growth into the same kind of quest as your favorite quests to get your favorite magic items.
The Manual of the Planes thing also leads into what I think is one of the main reasons they made prestige classes, which is so the one D&D book I still own is the third edition Manual of the Planes. And I opened it up physically before we started recording and also reread those classes and looked at the Gatecrasher. And I saw that the four prestige classes they include in the Manual of the Planes are like a cleric, the Gatecrasher, who's basically a thief with some planar stuff lopped on there, an arcane class with some planar stuff like lopped on there, and a ranger that has a favored plane instead of a favored enemy. And it really felt like, yes, prestige classes are this perfect tool to stick some player-facing content into a book that is otherwise just for dungeon masters. And I remember from reading all of these 3 and 3.5 edition books, how many books went that way, like worked that way. It was
Yeah, I mean,
very, very just
it's.
like, this is the reason that everyone needs to buy this book, not just your GM, you know?
I mean, yeah, there are a lot of material realities and commercial interests that are driving a lot of the decisions in pretty much any edition of Dungeons and Dragons, but especially third edition, which I think you're describing, what you're describing to me is exactly true, that they were a really easy way to sell more books to players, which, you know, you see in fifth edition, for example. They just, pretty much everything is GM facing. It's all adventures, and they have a different structure of how they sell books. But
they figured out that DMs are the people who buy the books.
Right. So I think the thing that gestures towards, which is something that I found frustrating with prestige classes, is that they have this amazing opportunity that I've tried to articulate around how they can tie the characters to the world and enmesh their character growth goals with their questing goals and the bringing it to the present, as you said. And then I think in actual practice, what they end up being a lot of the times is like tools for character optimization, or, you know, you find one that does the thing your character's already doing, but with some slightly better synergies, and just take that thing instead. And so it's like, oh, I'm a guy who fights with a sword. Yeah. Now I'm a sword master. And I'm basically just a swordier fighter. And a lot of, I think, the potential for prestige classes gets kind of lost there. And you can see by the time 3.5 Dungeon Master's Guide is released, the language about how they talk about prestige classes, even when they're just teeing them up, is actually really different in a way that I was surprised by.
Yeah. So in the third edition, we start with prestige classes. In the city of Greyhawk, a shadowy guild of hired killers wields power and fear like deadly weapons. Only the most ruthless and yet subtle women and men can join the guild as members. Cool. And by the time we get to 3.5, we have prestige classes. Prestige classes offer a new form of multiclassing. Unlike the basic classes found in the player's handbook, characters must meet requirements before they can take their first level of a prestige class. It's totally swapped from the cool flavor thing that you were talking about to the mechanical character optimization thing.
Yeah. And I found that to be such a bummer. I mean, I think it's ultimately why I, you know, at the time kind of soured on prestige classes and was really excited when fourth edition came out and I was ready to jump on the fourth edition train. They actually reworked prestige classes in sort of an interesting way where they have these like Paragon Path and Epic Destiny. So it's like something you automatically take, but they got rid of prestige classes and it was much more like you have your character class and you're sticking with it. And even multi-classing was kind of downplayed. And at the time I was like, finally, they're just going to let me like play this archetype to the hilt and be the coolest version of a fighter instead of constantly trying to like game the system to get that one extra plus one bonus. But now that I look back on it, I can see what they were trying to do. And I just think it was such a cool idea. And it makes me sad that it's kind of this weird dead end in game design. I mean, Pathfinder completely got rid of it. You don't really see it anywhere else. And I keep thinking lately about like, how can I take up this mantle and try and do something interesting with prestige classes? I think that it's just so ripe for a fresh take on it. Someone who decides that prestige classes are cool and not everything wrong with Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. It feels like there would be tons of space in like elf game adventure modules to create organizations where when you join the organization, you gain some sort of ability. I mean, a lot of the elf game kinds of stuff, I think advancement works in a way. It's not mechanical in the way that prestige classes is, but it is very like fictional, diegetic, like advancement and character change happens because of the stuff that happens to your character and the stuff that your character does, the choices you make rather than leveling up. And I feel like there's room to make some of that more explicit maybe in specific adventures that are written for those games. But I also see the legacy of prestige classes in Heart, The City Beneath, which is a game I have complicated feelings about and hopefully one day we'll do a full episode about. But like the classes in that game are just objectively home runs. They are so cool. They are so weird. You've got like the deep apiarist who's made of bees, and you've got the like Vermician knight who is defender of a defunct subway system and can eventually gain the ability to summon a train to run over its enemies. You know, like these classes are absurd. They're so wild. And the first time I read them, my first thought was, oh yeah, why weren't you allowed to just start being the prestige classes immediately in Dungeons and Dragons? Like, why aren't these things just variant classes? Like, give me that weird freak shit immediately. Why do I have to wait for it? I feel like there's so much of that in D&D of this, like, advancement as this aspirational thing. But, like, no one in their life, no one in the history of Dungeons and Dragons has ever gotten to play a 20th level PC, even though there are cool abilities kick in there. Like, just give me the cool shit immediately. And that's what I wish we got more of. The way Hart handles that is exactly what I would like to see more from, and what I wish people would take from of prestige classes, that the abilities you can give people right away can be cool and powerful, and more than anything else, specific.
Yeah, so I'm going to push back on that in a second, but I want to say first that I basically completely agree with you. And like, if not 9 times out of 10, 8 times out of 10, just give me a playbook or a character class that just, every one of them should make me want to play it. Every one of them should just explode my brain with ideas. And Hart does that so well. You know, Spire did that in the same way. I think the best Powered by the Apocalypse games do that as well. That said, I think there's something beautiful about the fact that prestige classes, and important about the fact that prestige classes aren't what you start with, because they allow for character change and character aspiration. And it's really cool to start off being someone interesting and specific, but it's also really cool to start off as, you know, a farmhand who has big dreams. It's really cool to be Luke Skywalker or Rey as a nobody scavenger on a desert planet. I mean, people get really hung up on numbers go up as an idea in Dungeons and Dragons, that like what they really get excited about and the thing that is really powerful for them is that constant improvement. But for me, when I think about fantasy stories, especially epic fantasy stories, what I think about is how often you see these characters having really meaningful and qualitative change rather than quantitative change. So I think about the journey that Aragorn goes on over the course of Lord of the Rings, right? Where he starts off and he's this mysterious ranger, sketchy guy. And then we discover that he is a king in exile, and he kind of changes into the king in exile as soon as we find that out about him. And then eventually he becomes the king. And all of those steps are very discrete moments of character change and character growth, and he becomes a different guy. I think about, you know, Arya Stark, who starts off as kind of just a, you know, a tomboy who rejects the trappings of being a young noble girl. And she starts training as a swordswoman, but then she ultimately makes this jump to being, you know, an assassin in training. And along the way, also she becomes the cupbearer, you know, for a whole season. And she's learning from Tywin Lannister about what power looks like. And so every season in a lot of these, or every book in a fantasy series, you almost, it's almost like these characters become a different character and have a different arc for that story.
Yeah.
And so I think prestige classes kind of gesture towards that in a really cool way, where it's like, I started off and I was the farmhand, and then at level 5, I became the lore master, you know? And
yeah,
I don't think prestige classes quite capture that as well as they could. I think part of it is, you never get to start off as a farmhand in Dungeons & Dragons 3rd edition, but I think that it gestures towards that idea in a really cool way.
Well, I think that that's actually a perfect encapsulation of like my problem with D&D, because I think what you identified there of like this qualitative change in characters is so much what that genre is based on, and it's the exciting thing about that genre to me. But because D&D is so built around and locked into this aspirational numerical advancement, the best it can do is gesture towards that changing of quality through something like prestige classes. Whereas I would much rather play a game that just had a different kind of advancement, where advancement works like, I love it in Stewpot, where you start with a bunch of adventurer experiences and you slowly give them up for town experiences that allow you to do different things. You trade in your fireball for the ability to cook. And both of those things are equally valuable within the context of playing the game and enacting your agency on the world. And I think that like not every game has to be like that. You can still have games that I'm excited about that prioritize that ability to cast fireball, but like the point of the advancement is something really different than get number higher.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I do think there's something to like this idea that these fantasy characters, they categorically change, you know, like Arya changes in a lot of different ways, but her list of people who have wronged her, who she's planning to kill, only grows over time.
Oh, that sounds like a sick advancement mechanic. I want that advancement mechanic.
Yeah, no, I think I want to be really clear for anyone who maybe didn't experience third edition. I'm not saying that prestige classes are like a secret amazing mechanic that was done wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they fail, honestly. I think it's a failed mechanic, but I think it's a really interesting failure, and it's disappointing to me that everyone just kind of left it there.
Yeah, I mean, I would say even though they became this vehicle for character optimization, I mean, 3.5 like rewrote everything to be about character optimization because that's how people were playing the game. Prestige classes in some ways were swept up by the tide of third edition and what direction it was headed. And like, I think were a really cool attempt at something different, something more like the kind of advancement that I think you and I are really excited about within this existing system. Like they I think did the best they could.
100%. Yeah, no, I mean, if they're the best you can do with a game that is fundamentally numbers go up. And when the numbers going up is so central to how the game is presented, then it becomes central to how people think about it and what they strive towards. And then all of a sudden you're just, you know, you're picking your prestige classes because the numbers go up.
Got her.
Here we go!
Oh my God, he threw,
here
he
we
threw
go!
The chair.
He threw the chair.
And now he's getting it back all because right. He's gonna have to sit.
We are in Casey's home. That was Casey's actual chair.
You look out of the window and you see a Toyota Previa upside down on fire.
Oh my God. Oh.
But it's not nearby any trees or anything, so it's fine.
On fire.
It's fine. It's not fine to me, GM. Jesus Christ, that's my fucking car.
Dynamite headbutt.
He screams as he headbutts this man.
Honestly, his left jaundiced eyeball pops out of his head.
Oh! And if you were to take a picture the second their two heads were touching, it might have been an intimate, tender scene between friends or lovers. But if you were to take a picture at any other second, yeah. It is just absolutely horrifying.
For some men, violence is a form of intimacy, which is so sad.
That is
maybe
so
for
sad.
This man. But anyway. Boom! Smashed in the head!
Bodhi has a pocket full of, like, one oversized precious moment angel that has a real strange face.
Oh, I thought that was your dick.
Oh! It was his dick. There's a hole in his pocket and his penis, which does resemble a precious moment angel with a strange face.
Oh, it's a strange face, but it actually looks like a pretty normal penis head.
And that's what we call facts.
He looks back and he says one last threatening phrase, pointing to the bar.
I'm gonna. And Violet shoots him in the head.
You see this guy's ear get blown off, flying off his head.
Ah! Bye bye.
And then at this point, Scratch pops up like a mummy.
Ah, mummy! Headbutt!
Dynamite headbutt!
Something is rising, piecing itself together from the bodies and viscera around it. Its black wings spread, and it looks back at you with red, wet eyes.
Got her.
One thing I actually didn't talk about yet. Solidly half the prestige classes in the game are prestige classes that no character would ever take. And, you know, we talked about the assassin at the very beginning of the podcast who needs to kill somebody for no other reason than to join the Assassin's Guild. And like, maybe you're running an evil campaign, but realistically, that's probably not a PC. There's also the Blackguard, who's an evil paladin. And these are just two out of like the seven in the Dungeon Master's Guide. You know, and then there's like I have the Book of Vile Darkness, and which is a really wild book. I don't know if I can recommend it. I don't recommend it. But it has a whole section of like 15 prestige classes. And it says right up front, like, none of these are really suitable for a player character. And most of them involve human sacrifice.
And, oh my God.
And I think there's something like so fascinating about what it means to take a mechanic, like a player-facing mechanic, and then say, these are not for players. And I think it actually, you know, you could say that this is, it's bad design. You could say it's just temptation. Like, of course, we're going to run our evil campaign now because at some point someone's going to want to play a cancer mage who gets a tumor familiar, which is what?
Oh my God.
Disgusting. Absolutely disgusting.
That rules.
It's awesome. But it's, either you love it or you're like, I'm done with this immediately. But it's another way that it speaks to their attempts to try and do something really interesting that ended up kind of falling flat. Because what it does also, and third edition carried this through to its entire structure, was that the player-facing rules and the NPC-facing rules were identical. And that was often nightmarish for a dungeon master. But what it says is these are people who you might meet out in the world. So every time you're reading this player-facing text, even if you know you're never going to play that character, you now it's like you get to read the monster manual, but in a safe way. You know, you're not, as a player, you're not supposed to read the monster manual, but you do get to read the prestige classes and get to imagine all the enemies you might fight. You get to like know who's out there in the world. So you can imagine a version where you hand your players the prestige classes that are available at the start of your homebrew campaign. And half of them are evil organizations like the Red Wizards of Thay. And now you read through that prestige class and you're like, oh man, I don't like that those guys are out there in the setting and I hope I don't run into them. And it does that all in an interesting mechanical way, rather than kind of needing to tell you explicitly, like, this is an enemy that, like, no one likes to read a setting. I mean, GMs do, but like most, if you hand your players a setting sheet at the beginning of the campaign, they're not going to read it. But if you hand them 15 player facing classes that they can't actually take, they'll read all of them anyway.
Cause maybe they could.
Yeah, no, I had an infamous evil campaign where they turned evil, and then it was like, oh, if we'd gone a little longer, I would have let them get some evil prestige class. It would have been fun.
Yeah, well, that's a perfect transition, actually, to the next thing that I wanted to say,
sure,
which is going back to your farmhand
and
the dream of starting as a farmhand and then becoming a fighter and then becoming... help me out with the prestige class here. What does a fighter eventually become?
Battle master or master of chains was one I written down because everyone I know, one of the fun things about prestige classes was that you're like, I want to be someone who uses chains, but they're just terrible. They're just worse than a sword. And so they make a prestige class. I was like, now you can be really good at chains.
Yeah, to make them good. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm excited to be a fighter. And then once I'm a fighter, I'm like, oh, I want to be the chain master. And like, great. So we're dreaming of becoming the chain master. But third edition always let me down, like trained me to become jaded about that fantasy because no campaign ever fucking went on long enough to actually get there. Like, I played some pretty years-long campaigns, and in like the longest ones, one person maybe got a prestige class. And the most iconic character from my third edition days who got a prestige class got it because the DM waived the requirements in the class because he just thought it was cool. Like, that's so much of D&D. That's so much of the problem I have with the aspirational advancement in D&D and why I want to just do the cool thing now.
Right.
Because, like, I know Christmas is coming and this campaign is falling the fuck apart when it does.
It's funny because, like, now I'm thinking about it and, like, I actually can't think of a single prestige class that was taken by any player in any of the games that I ever played in or ran while playing third edition. And I think that speaks to something interesting, which is like, to your point, like when you're thinking about the prestige class you want to have, you're maybe not happy with your character right now. And when the campaign is really singing, when the diegetic storytelling is really good, then you're in the story and you want to keep playing because you're interested in the story. You're not interested in getting a fireball. You're interested in what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, are they going to stop the wizard before he blows up the world or whatever it is? And, you know, and when you're focused more on the mechanics of like, one day I'm going to get fireball, that's kind of sometimes a sign that you're not invested in the story. And then the campaign, maybe there's not enough energy in that campaign because suddenly, like my experience with third edition was because there were so many Slack books, because there's so much content coming out all the time. It was very easy to get into that grass is greener mindset and be like, this campaign is pretty fun, but like, what if I do a desert campaign and you're going to be this new like desert lizard man race that I got that came out in this new book, and you're going to be like a sand dwarf and we're going to fight some mind flayers or, you know, like there was always something new to try.
Yeah.
And so like my favorite character that I ran was just a fighter. He specialized in grappling, but he was just a fighter who like took some specific feats. And I think that kind of really says it all that like, prestige classes were this amazing. I think the thing I was talking about more with about the villains is actually kind of where they were at their best. Was you'd pick up these books and you'd read them.
They were like imagination fuel.
Yeah, like you can't pick up a D&D third edition book, flip to the prestige class chapter, and not just like end up with your brain full of ideas and excitement. They're so compelling as a concept. They don't really land in play at all, but like they're joy to read.
Yeah. I think the other point that you've made several times that is really good is the blending of mechanics and diegesis is really fun in these too. Like I'm looking right now at the Dwarven Defender prestige class, where you had to be a dwarf. It's right there in the fucking name. Like, you have to be a dwarf, and apparently your alignment has to be lawful. And, like, then there's some mechanical stuff too, but, like, it's cool to imagine that the dwarves have their own class. That this is, like, a cultural class, not just exactly a mechanical thing. And now I'm imagining the, like, whole hall of dwarves. And this is the other thing about prestige classes that I think were really, really good. The art of the Dwarven Defender is cool to me. And it's like, I can see him in the Dwarven throne room. I can see like 12 of them on either side of the Dwarven Queen just sitting there, like holding their giant shields and defending her, right? That's cool. And that prestige classes have all of that.
Well, and that's another good example though, because it's like, even if I'm never going to become a Dwarven Defender, when I walk into the hall of the Dwarven Queen, I know that there's going to be a group of amazing Dwarven Defenders who are powerful and intensely focused and lawful, and they're going to be standing around her, right? Like I know what to expect now. And that's a powerful way that they work in the game. It's just such good world building. I feel like we've been talking about how like the mechanics and the diegesis are kind of at odds with the prestige classes in a lot of ways. But one of the things that I think is really interesting is like, and my spicy take right now, and you mentioned Heart before, which is such a good example, because Heart has its beats. Do you want to describe how Heart?
Yeah, so the way Heart beats work is you pick a couple of beats that you have going at any given time. So like charm someone with tales of your exploits, or acquire a rare or powerful D12 value item, preferably magic. And then once you accomplish these beats in the story, you mark them off and you gain new class abilities as a result.
And so the reason I mention that is because, and this is my like one of my most heretical ideas as a indie story gamer, is that like sometimes I feel like you just say the thing, you just say, this is a story beat, you're going to hit this episode or this session. So sometimes it takes the joy out of it for me a little bit as someone who has been a screenwriter. You know, like I can see the story happening. And if I see the story happening, I kind of get a little bit taken out of it. And then I don't feel like I engage my writer brain, and all of a sudden I'm not exactly playing to find out what happens. I'm like, mm-hmm, sort of imagining what could happen and playing toward what I want to happen.
You're playing to find out how it happens rather than what happens.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm maneuvering my way toward what I want to happen through the tools of story. And so I'm kind of intrigued by the way prestige classes take such a mechanical approach to these diegetic story beats, because I think there's something really emergent that could happen with a better version of this. It almost happens, mm-hmm, where you're just playing your guy. This whole game is really just simulating the world and simulating what's there. But through this extremely simulated approach through this extremely simulationist approach to game design, you end up with stories and character arcs and things like that. And they feel, if it lands right, they feel really authentic because no one was trying to make that happen. And that's something I'm always looking for in my design, is how can you kind of do both of those things, where you can have really compelling story arcs, but kind of make it a little bit more like a magic trick so that people aren't playing towards story arcs. They're just playing what feels right, or what makes sense, or what will make the numbers go up. And then all of a sudden they turn around and they're like, wow, we're in a story arc now. And it was really good.
Yeah. I sometimes have trouble with that magic trick style play. Like, I do think it is often more efficient to just kind of like tell people what the fuck happens, or like what they should do now. But I do think that there's a big strength in how prestige classes create a goal for characters compared to like heartbeats, which create like scenes for players to hit.
Yeah, that's the thing. Prestige classes at their best are character facing, and heartbeats are player facing. I want to be able to describe what I want as a player in a way that would be coherent to the character. So I want my character to be a purple dragon knight, and I want my character to want to be a purple dragon knight. And what I want is for then it
to, you want to be aligned with that guy.
Yeah, and then I want it to be hard. Like, I also, as a player, have a secondary want of wanting it to be hard to become a purple dragon knight. You know, I want the DM to put challenges in front of me, but in the moment, I want to be like, hey, I'm just trying to be a Purple Dragon Knight, and I can just take steps that will push me towards being a Purple Dragon Knight in a very clear way that will then, through the game's mechanics, make it really interesting.
Well, Sam, is there anything else that you want to talk about with prestige classes?
I just want to reiterate something I already said, which is that I think prestige classes, flawed as they are a really interesting concept that was not executed to their full potential. And I'm going to start playing with some of these ideas, and I encourage people to take it out for a spin too. It's funny, I'm like doing the, shoot, I'm like getting meta again, but like I feel like I'm like angling for the Other Kind thing where everyone was like, you did that episode about Other Kind dice, and everyone was like, now I want to make an Other Kind game. And what I want is everyone to make a prestige class game.
I feel like every episode of this show that I do, I end up angling for that at the end. But like, yeah. I agree about prestige classes. Like, I personally think the people we should be talking to are the Elf Game Adventure writers. Like, I think the most exciting place to try to take this technology is to put it deeper into the fiction, like a mechanical reward for fictional action. Like, if you are out there designing a dungeon and your dungeon is full of mushroom people, like, make it so that there's a mushroom people prestige class that the players know about and they can go try to get by being friends with the mushroom people. Like, that to me is the most exciting thing to do with this. And I would love to read adventures that are doing stuff like that.
And I see in a lot of like elf gamey adventures where they do things that are almost that, but usually it's something that sort of just happens to the character over time. And often it's not something necessarily positive. And so I would say, take that idea and just make sure that the players know about it early on and that it's something they want. You can use character growth and advancement as a lure just as much as you can use a really cool magic item.
Yeah, and like so much of that elf game world advancement is about that, well, what happens to the person. But I think like an important part of that is that can be a proactive thing, not just a reactive thing. Like, it doesn't just have to be my character evolves because they go into the dungeon and get cursed. It can be they evolve because they go into the dungeon and like retrieve the blessing that they went into the dungeon to retrieve in the first place. And more stuff like that would be cool.
Right. And it unlocks so much of the elf game space right now is built around this core idea of you're searching for gold. And I think it unlocks another thing you could be searching for. So what can we do with that? Let's find out. We're going to play to find out.
We're going to design to find out.
Yes. The Dice Exploder mantra, design to find out.
Thanks again to Sam for coming on. You can escape from Dino Island yourself on Itched. It's funny. I just wrote in here, you can escape from Dino Island on Itch. It should be you can find Escape from Dino Island on Itch. But I like you can escape from Dino Island on Itch. I'm just going to keep all this in. As always, you can find me on socials at S. Dunnewald or on the Dice Exploder Discord. Our logo was designed by Sporgery. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesfer. And thanks to you for listening. See you next time.